Good morning, everyone. Oh, that worked quite well. Good morning, everyone, and a very, very warm welcome to the Actuaries Institute. My name is Nicolette Rubinstein, and I am the 2017 Vice President of the Actuaries Institute. And I'm really delighted to welcome you all here today. It is our first ever Young Actuaries Conference. So today is all about building skills. It's about you as our younger members and how you build the skills to have successful and purposeful careers. Now, Jenny Lyon is actually our current president, and Jenny has been very passionate about this event, but unfortunately was unable to attend today. So what she's done is actually left us a little video message, which I don't have the technological skills to play, so welcome to the lovely Liz.
Good morning. I'm Jenny Lyon. I'm the President of the Actuaries Institute for 2017. I've recorded this introduction because I'm particularly disappointed that I'm missing the conference here today, as I'm going to be travelling overseas. A key part of my message as President is around young people and wanting to be engaged more with you for the profession. You are the future of our profession, so it's important that we listen to your perspectives and that we harness your energy and enthusiasm for our profession for the future. This is a really exciting time to be at an early part in your career. There are many opportunities in our changing world, and in particular things like an increased focus on data and how it's being used commercially has got to offer opportunities for actuaries and other data professionals, and particularly those who can also bring a business and judgment to the party. In our more traditional areas, we're also facing challenges, such as an aging population, climate change, and changes in consumer expectations. From a career perspective, these options can also look like challenges. Which way do I take my career? In my experience, careers evolve. And so I just encourage you to be flexible in your thinking, to listen, to learn, ask questions, be curious, and perhaps, most importantly, to be brave, to put your hand up for opportunities. And they may be actuarial related, or they may not be. In both cases, you're going to learn a lot. Then have an opinion and seek to make a difference. This conference today is a great opportunity for you to meet with your peers, exchange ideas, and make new connections. You also have a great range of speakers to learn from. And I'd encourage you to really ask them some hard questions and then take those learnings away with you into the workforce and build the future for our profession. I hope you have a great day. I look forward to hearing about it. I'd also hope that I'll meet many of you during the year and encourage you to contact me with any thoughts that you have, which you can do via the Actuaries Institute. Thank you.
That might be the most fun we have all day, the baby animals. So Jenny is a wonderful president. I am absolutely loving working with her. And as she said, she's got an absolute focus on the younger generation of actuaries. And now I would like to thank our sponsors on behalf of the Institute. We've got two sponsors, SKL and Finity. Finity are sponsoring your lanyards, the lovely ones around your neck, and SKL are sponsoring our hospitality breaks, morning tea, lunch, and afternoon tea, and I think we'll be very grateful to them as well. A word on social media. We invite you to follow the seminar on Twitter, and you can use the hashtag 2017YAC. A polite reminder to turn your mobiles to silent. And now we can actually get the show on the road. I personally feel very thrilled to be around all this youth and enthusiasm. I really encourage you to get involved today, to participate, ask questions. We have a great agenda, so we've got plenaries on the actuarial passport, actuary of the future, talking the talk, and then strategic thinking, leadership, and personal brand. I'm going to be around most of the day. I really would love to meet you. Please come up, introduce yourself. Would love to have a chat. And I'm now going to introduce the facilitator of our first plenary, who is Avanti Patki. She is an actuarial graduate working in at AMP. She graduated with a Bachelor of Actuarial Studies and a Bachelor of Science in 2014. She's worked in the life insurance industry for just over 2 years now, and she's had experience, I can't believe how much she's done in 2 years actually, wealth management valuations, insurance strategy, asset and liability management, and actuarial pricing. So please join me in welcoming Avanti. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicolette. Hi, everybody. I'm Avanti Patki. I'm going to be your chair for this plenary. So our first plenary of the day, we'll look at the international opportunities with Jaz Singh speaking on the actuarial market as it stands today and in the future. We've got Raymond Bennett and Liz Martin also speaking about their personal experiences working overseas as well. If you have any questions, please be sure to just raise your hand. Just wait for a roving mic to come to you just so the guys in the webinar can hear you guys. And just state your name and your company for recording purposes. So let's get into it. Introduce the speakers. First off, we've got the famous Mr. Jaz Singh. Jaz, who's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries, has over 10 years actuarial experience working in life insurance, non-life insurance and wealth management, both in Australia and the UK. He's currently a member of the Commercial Actuarial Practice Faculty and the Life Insurance Assessments Project of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. Jaz entered actuarial recruitment in 2011 and has established himself as a leading and widely respected consultant in the Australian market since. He's increasingly looking to do more work in Asia, given the rapid growth rates in the region. So Jaz, take it away.
Well, yeah, thank you, Avanti. That was a nice introduction. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. That's a sizable audience we've got. Well done, committee. So, look, I am here to talk about overseas job markets. Now, in that, I'll cover different markets in Asia, New Zealand, UK, a little bit on US. We'll talk about different markets, what they offer you, how they can help your career, how you can get into them. But before going into the markets, like most of my actuarial presentations, I still like to start with the career plan, because I think before you decide to go, it's best to think about why you're going there and how is that going to help you get to the next career step. So let's try and make it an interactive session. Feel free to raise your hand or make an opinion or share your knowledge. I just like to see a raise of hands of people who are contemplating to work overseas someday. Doesn't have to be now. Oh wow, that's really good. Very encouraging. Would a couple of people like to share why they would like to work abroad? Yeah.
Hi, my name is Tim. I'm from KPMG. I would like to work abroad because I think, firstly, culture is very different across different countries, and I think the Australian working culture will be different to working overseas as well, and then at the same time, I think the regulation systems and also the work that I'll get overseas will be different. For example, if I go to Netherlands, I might be able to work on some CDC work rather than your DC system here, as an example. So I think that's why I want to work overseas.
Yeah, so culture and variety of experience. Yeah. Anybody from who's not on the committee? Oh, that's fine. Although we got one here.
Hi there, George from PDOBS. So the main reason is just for travel. So somewhere like Europe, you can just, you know, fly 2 hours, get into another country, whereas you fly 2 hours, you get to like, what, Melbourne, Brisbane?
Fiji. Oh, thank you, George. Honest as always. Thank you. Okay, now that kind of sums up what goes on in most people's heads. You know, certainly people, the audience at this age, travels, variety of experience. It's just that curiosity, that defining what goes on abroad, and that takes a lot of people abroad. Plus, friends are going, so I want to go. That's a valid reason too. Now, I'd just like to share my thoughts on ideal time of making that move. And some of it is my observations of when I see people, given I work in recruitment, I know and meet lots of people, and I see lots of people go abroad, or I see some people come to Australia, same sort of reasons. And so my observations by observing them, and also personal experience, I also made the move to UK about a long time ago now. And some of those reasons for going were similar, but maybe the timing wasn't the greatest. So in my view, it is probably best that you finish your exams before going. Now, if you want to be a fellow, do the fellowship exams. If you don't want to be a fellow, then get, you know, whatever accreditation you aspire to. Because traveling, working abroad, finding a new house, moving out of your parents' house, living in London in shared accommodation doesn't go well with studying. And this is personal experience. So that's one. Two, I would say get some life experience before making the move. And some of that is like maybe travel once or twice to a country that you want to move to. At least you know what you're getting yourself into. And two, get some life experience. So what I mean by that is, IQ is important, but EQ, you know, in a global sense, is probably more important. So get an understanding of how people think. How are you going to go to land in a foreign country, go work in insurance or consulting in Hong Kong? And then EQ is just so important, just to gauge how people operate in those environments. Because quite often, your next employer will be looking at how you will fit in to the culture there. And to fit in, you really got to grasp how they operate, and you got to be around, and you got to be observant, and you got to essentially gel in that environment. A few other things would be perhaps language. It's a privilege being, you know, living in Australia and speaking most widely spoken language in the world. But it is not the only language spoken in the world. Certainly in Asia, Mandarin is increasingly getting important. Europe obviously has its own languages. Most importantly, if you know, some markets like France and Germany are big actuarial markets. We'll touch on that. But language is a key barrier in entering those places. Okay, so we'll... So we'll talk about different job markets. It's a big world out there. So I broke it down essentially in Asia, Hong Kong, Singapore, China, India, Southeast Asia. Then we'll talk about Europe and New Zealand and other places. I also must say I was in Africa last year as well, South Africa, for an actuarial conference. And whilst it's not on lots of people's radar, it is a big market, and in due course it will start to attract good talent, in my judgment. Okay, so Hong Kong, big city, big smoke. First time I went there, I just couldn't help looking at how dense it was, and how many tall buildings the place has. It's just nuts, and how energetic it is. It is more or less a 24-hour city. From actuarial sense, it's a great place for really advancing your career, because the reason is that it's a regional hub, so it has lots of regional headquarters for broad Asia. It's particularly strong on the life insurance side and banking side and investment side. It's seen some huge growth in premiums. The reasons for that we won't go to here, but largely because of China getting wealthy, a lot of the money travels around, and it's finding itself in Hong Kong insurance company premiums. And the nature of the products is more old-fashioned. It's endowment type products, not just so the risk is not unbundled there. It's a bundled product. Now, again, going back to the optimal timing for Hong Kong, it's a pretty cruel place if you're an analyst, because someone told me that most actuarial analysts are barely above the poverty line, and not many can afford to live out of home. It's just how Hong Kong works, or in some ways how Asia works, is the pay scale tends to be quite steep. Like if you're junior, you don't get paid as much. However, if you get a bit older, you get paid lots of money. So there's a way to time entry there. I think get qualified, get a few years experience, get some people management experience. That's another thing I forgot to mention. That's big. If you want to go into management ranks, you need to manage people in Asia. So if you've got about 5 to 8 years experience, I think it's a good time to start, and you're qualified, or you've reached an actuary accreditation, that's what you want to do, is the best time to start considering Hong Kong. Because you will get a few years to build your Asian experience, and Asia is different. Things move a lot quicker. There are a lot of deals around. If you're working in reinsurance side, there are. If you're looking at regional companies, there are. You know, this market is 10 times the size of Australia. And the expertise in actual insurance houses isn't as great as it is here. So if you're in a reinsurer or a consulting company, there are lots and lots of things around which need to be turned around quickly. You need to be on top of your game. Need to be responsive. If you have all those attributes, your career can really accelerate very quickly, because it's a great place where I've seen people reach very senior roles at relatively young ages, which I haven't observed so much in Australia. And as you progress, certainly if you're looking for a great salary advancement, Hong Kong is quite good. Now Singapore is same but different. It is different because it's more focused on general insurance. All the life insurance is building up there, but Hong Kong is more the life hub for Asia. Singapore is, for one thing, it's a lot cleaner and it's different. It has a different vibe to it. I mean, I'm just talking about that. I think lots of people have traveled, so it's important to look at the city and the opportunities, not just the opportunities, because you've got to live there. It has a very different vibe to Hong Kong in my experience. It's quite organized. I heard a few years ago the kind of thinking they have is they all of a sudden realized that cities with greater gay population tend to be more innovative and economically successful. And so therefore they started encouraging gay population. This is quite a different sort of example, but that's how the city works. It's very organized in its thinking, and they kind of operate a bit differently. But having said that, they're very, very, very successful. And probably if you are planning to stay in Asia longer term and planning to have families and things, I've heard from expats that Singapore is more family friendly, has bigger size accommodation and better schooling options. But this is all hearsay, I don't know personally, but a lot of people have told that to me, so probably he's right. Now, China. Big market. Elisa, who works with me, was telling me that Ping An and China Life are two of the top five biggest insurance companies in the world. And when I looked at the top 10, I think there were another three or four. This is all life insurance. So Chinese companies are clearly starting to get the scale and the weight behind them. And wouldn't be too long, I think, before they start going abroad and start taking over other companies. Language and cultural awareness in China is absolute must. Mandarin is the key, and knowing how China works is the key. I've had some friends who have done stints in reinsurers in China, help set them up. It's quite dynamic, but the way things get done, again, is different. Because of the evolution of the commercial stage they're at, cultural understanding is the key there. I'll quickly go over the other markets. India I put there because I recently became aware they have allowed complete foreign ownership of insurance companies. Previously, they were working on some sort of JV structure, which didn't seem to work as well. So in times to come, as the market gets more freer, I think it'll present more commercial opportunities and opportunities for actuaries. Southeast Asia is a good one. A lot of the actuarial centers are run in Singapore or Hong Kong, which manage these places, but certainly if you know the language and are culturally aware, it's a very quick way to jump in the executive ranks. There are actuaries who are managing directors, CFOs, some of them are barely 33, 34. They do get some good senior experience there, and which they can take across the world later on. Okay, so overseas job market, UK, Europe. Now this is I think more appealing to people who perhaps like the European travels. London has always been the place where people like to settle down for a few years and take the opportunity to fly around Europe, and even America. New York's not that far away. Now, the Brexit is the first thing on everyone's sort of mind of seeing what's going on. My understanding is nothing's really changed. The actuarial market's still busy. There's still lots of jobs. There are lots of opportunities. And companies, in due course, as the European passporting thing expires, we'll probably look to sponsor more people from Australia. So UK will always be a good option. Travel-wise, it's great. When I went, it also was a place where you could increase your salary quite a bit just by the effect of sterling. That's not so much there. From what I've seen in the salaries, certainly on the contracting side, UK is quite attractive, but on the permanent side, it looks like Australia probably has the edge now. There are a few other countries in Europe. Switzerland is turning to be another centre. I've seen a few actuaries from Australia move to Switzerland, certainly on the reinsurance and consulting side. Language is less of a barrier there. You could get by on English, although they do appreciate if you have some knowledge of German. German because it's most of the places are in Zurich. Great lifestyle, great skiing. Most people who've gone there very rarely tend to come back. So that tells you something about the place. From a career point of view, It's because the actuarial qualification and other things work differently in Europe. They have a different way to qualification. I think they're more tertiary based university type qualification. The kinds of activities that actuaries do, certainly as far as being senior in the organisation, I think they're not as senior on average as they are in, say, UK or Australia or Asia. That's something to look out for. But it all depends on organisation to organisation. Now, there are other markets that I've seen people from Australia go to, Germany, Paris. Again, great places, good global exposure. Again, consulting is probably your best bet there, because you can work across different places. You're working across the same platforms, like using the same software as here. Sometimes you have to use your logic for Solvency 2 type work. So a lot of the experience is transferable. It's quite good. And so the reason for bringing New Zealand was that whilst it's quite a small market, it is a market that I have worked in a bit. And my observation was that whoever's gone from Australia to New Zealand have been able to rapidly advance their career because there just seems to be less people ahead of you in New Zealand, whereby you can really accelerate and get your senior titles at relatively younger ages. Now, Jenny Lyon and I wrote an article in the Actuary magazine last year about the benefits of working in New Zealand. And if you are interested, it is worth looking at that. We covered why you'd go there, how long is the optimal time, and perhaps even we covered the lifestyle benefits as well. And there's quite a few. It's a good senior country. Now, one of the speakers here I noticed, Greg's going to be here, isn't he? Yeah. He went to New Zealand for about 4 or 5 years, got a really good role with AMP, and he's back here. So that did him a lot of good. So it might be worth asking him a few questions about New Zealand if you get hold of him. Now, my last slide is essentially the US. Now, I'll put that there. I was in America 2 weeks ago. And every time I go to America, I certainly, I like the place, got a buzz about it. I can't help notice the fact how big it is. When you look at Australia, it's like a state equivalent of America. And the actual opportunities for actuaries are a lot. There are lots and lots of work going on. Now, one of the things, if you do want to go to America, is you got to plan it. You got to plan it the most out of if you want to go to different countries, because America, by nature, is very much about America. I don't think they appreciate or want to really know what people outside do in the actual sector. It's very insular, so a lot of people have had difficulty talking to recruiters. They haven't had the reception of knowing how transferable a skill set is. So it is very doable if you put your mind to it, but something you just got to, again, be aware of what you're getting yourself into and how to get there. In terms of visas, I know that there is some sort of special visa arrangement that there exists, and it's quite easy to get a visa for Australian nationals to go to America. So that's less of an issue. It's more about having your CV design and your comms quite clear as to be able to sell yourself to American employers, and that needs a bit of homework into how that market works and speaking to lots of people there and then sitting back and planning it through. So that's about all I had to say. Happy to take questions now or later.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jazz, for all those very frank insights. I'm pretty sure everybody appreciated that. Next up, we've got Ray Bennett. Raymond Bennett is a director at Deloitte Australia with over 20 years of experience in the actuarial profession, mostly in consulting, but also including 4 years of industry experience. He's been qualified as an FIAA since 2002. Ray has worked mainly in life insurance, but has experience in other fields, including general insurance. He enjoys M&A work and technical actuarial work in particular. Ray has lived all over the world, including, wait for it, Australia, Malaysia, UK and South Africa, and has worked in a number of other countries as well. So Ray has been involved in the actuarial profession and currently volunteers as a specialist lecturer on the online professionalism course for the UK IFOA. And Ray also enjoys reading, travelling of course, and spending quality time with his wife and two kids. So put your hands together for Ray. Thank you.
Thanks for the intro. Okay, so I'm your first live case study of what you do when you go overseas, and I can certainly say that I learned a few things from Jazz that maybe I should have known 20 years ago. So the first thing I did when I was preparing this talk is I sort of thought about, you know, those little tools, where have you been? So that's where I've been. So I've got a lot of places still to go, and I think that's probably going to remain the case for the next little while. But firstly, I was actually born in Zimbabwe. So my family moved to Australia about 1989, so that gives my age away. I told my wife, if you're speaking at the younger actress session, you're not a younger actress anymore, but some people proved me wrong there. We moved around a bit in Australia, so we started in Brisbane, went up to Gladstone, went across to Perth. I did my last year of school in Perth, decided I'd become an actor and came across to Macquarie University up here. Then in those days, we didn't really have email, so we used to get letters from the Institute with job adverts, and I got a job advert for a reinsurer in Bermuda. I said, right, I'm going. Now, my parents then stepped in and said, well, you're not qualified, you haven't finished your exam. So they did give a little bit of that advice. So I said, well, okay, probably right, let's keep going. So I worked another year, and then I got a job advert for a job in Singapore. And I didn't speak to my parents this time. And I went. So I flew up to Singapore, and I landed on a Sunday, and the guys picked me up, and they took me to this sort of resort-like apartment block with a swimming pool, and then we went down to the boat club, and we had cocktails on the beach overlooking the thing. Jeez, this is pretty good. And then they said, you come into office tomorrow, and then you fly to Malaysia. I said, what? And they said, yeah, the modeling guys are in Malaysia. We need you to meet them and that sort of thing. So I flew up to Malaysia and met the guys and just never went back to Singapore, to be honest. That's not to say Singapore's bad. It's just I liked Malaysia. It was it had quite a good vibe. I was getting paid in Singapore dollars. The exchange rate was good. So life was good. And I had some good experience. I really like food. So barbecue stingray is one of my particular favorites. If you ever go to Kuala Lumpur, you have to go to the restaurant with the yellow tablecloth on Jalan Alor. That's where you get that. Actually, you order it from the place next door, but they bring it. I did a bit more traveling and accidentally asked what this funny bag of sort of balls in water were. And given we were in Sabah, in sort of what was Borneo, I probably shouldn't ask because my girlfriend at the time said they're tadpoles. So we bought two bags and had them for lunch. It's not bad, a bit like squid, quite tasty. As well as that, I got to do some travel. So this is me in Teotihuacan, sort of pyramids. I'm standing on the Pyramid of the Sun. Behind me is the Pyramid of the Moon. And that road that you see there is known as the Avenue of the Dead. So it was a good opportunity. To get back, so I was actually in Argentina. I had to fly to Chile, to Mexico, to Canada, to Japan, and back to Malaysia. So it was a 72-hour journey from door to door. It was okay, though, because I got to stay overnight in both Mexico City and Japan. So got a little bit of an experience there. Malaysians do things in an interesting way. So you can only see the front of this, but imagine that this is a bus. But it's missing everything but the chassis. So, yeah, this guy noticed me taking a photo and sort of posed a little bit. I climbed mountains, which was pretty good. I enjoyed that. and kept traveling again for work. This is Old Sana in Yemen. I'm not sure Yemen is particularly safe these days, but we went in just before things started to go scary. That was the most fascinating country from a cultural perspective, because you'd be sitting in a restaurant and a guy would sort of walk past you and his jacket would open and then be his pistol and his knife, and you know, it was a bit scary. But people are people. So this is my client's daughter and her niece, and we're going on a sort of a field trip. They were showing us some of the places in the countryside, and I sort of turned around and there they were sitting on the window. I just thought it was such a clash between having the sort of, you know, cultural clothing, but still being young, wild, and free. Anyway, it was fun, but I decided Malaysia was too fun, and I needed a serious career. And my girlfriend moved to London. But anyway, so I took a year off, moved to London, and London's great. I enjoyed London. I lived there. I planned on living there for 2 years, and I stayed there for 9. I still did some traveling. So this is Che Guevara on a building in Havana in Cuba. This is my honeymoon. It's a view from one of the places we stayed at Maria La Gorda. If you ever go to Cuba, it's all the way on the westernmost tip. Fantastic diving. I can't dive. Long story. But when you stay at this place, there's one hotel. Pay the extra $1 for the view. Otherwise, you end up in the mangrove swamps at the back. And that was particularly fascinating because when we were driving, there was a crab on the road. So I thought, oh, crab. Jumped out, took a photo of this crab. It's a big crab. Kept going. There's a couple more. Millions of them. We were right in the middle of the land crab migration. So I tried to avoid them, but yeah. Kept traveling. So this is me 10 years later, standing on the Temple of the Sun, Temple of the Moon in the background, my wife taking the photo. They're really dorky photos, but... And we traveled a bit around Europe too. Probably didn't go to all the places I want to go. I still haven't gone to Barcelona, but this was Madrid after the bullfighting that we went to, which again is culture, and you've got to read what's his name to get that. Anyway. My wife is South African. The London weather gets to you after a while, and we sort of decided to go back to South Africa. There's some good career opportunities. Jazz mentioned you sort of go to smaller markets. There's opportunities. At this point, I told my mother again, and she flipped out because we'd left Africa. Why were we going back? I think there's a whole bunch of psychological issues there for her. But anyway, so we decided to go there. And it's a great country. I love the country. We did some traveling. Favorite trip was up into Namibia. Fortunately, at this point, I've got my photos on an Apple thing, and I couldn't get them. But yeah, Namibia was great, except everybody got really sick. My son fell into a thorn bush and got bitten by a spider. So my wife hated the trip. We then decided, okay, we're gonna come back to Australia. That was after about 4 years, and at that point, my mother obviously is very happy. But what she didn't realize is that's actually the first leg on that circle. So who knows? Work-wise, I did do some work despite what I've just said. So the start of my career is all the usual, actual student things, data preparation. Started a bit of modeling. I got to do the experience investigation, learn a bit of Access, learn a bit of Moses. I was the guy who on New Year's Eve wasn't partying with everybody. I was in the office setting the runs off so that when we got in the office on January the 2nd, the results were ready. Hero. Then when I went to Asia, I finished off my exams over there. I got to sit in the Australian Embassy in Kuala Lumpur and do exams. That was fine, but the first time they didn't quite get that a 6-hour exam, you need to concentrate. So I was on like a mezzanine thing with a guy drilling down the bottom. But, you know, I got there. The Moses thing, I think, was my ticket to getting that job. And back in those days, it was a reasonably good job. I think salary went up quite a lot. It went up quite a bit. It was good. I did a lot of transactions, a lot of traveling. All of those sort of red countries in Asia were pretty much non-tourist trips. Obviously, I went to some places, but Indonesia, I worked in Indonesia, I worked in the Philippines, I worked in Malaysia, I worked in Singapore, Yemen, Argentina, Mexico. So that was, it was a lot of fun. And I got to be the IT guy in our office. That didn't last too long because, back in those days, the server was something that we just bought, and I got to install it and play with it. I took a year off, as I said, and again, I did traveling. I think I calculated I went pretty much around the world twice in that year. But, the money ran out, so I had to get a job. It was my first management role. I was leading the annuity valuation team for Legal & General in the UK. Quite interesting because that was the first exposure to the concept of longevity and the fact that we're actually living longer. We sort of know that as actuaries, but the sort of actual problems that introduces basically made my life quite difficult because on one hand, the industry was sort of recognizing that this was having a big impact on annuity liabilities. And on the other hand, we had a huge book of bulk purchase annuities, which is where you buy a pension scheme, buy in inverted commas, and the data is rubbish. So we spend lots of weekends cleaning the data to get a massive benefit to offset the massive hit to reserves. Here I'm me again. But I liked consulting. I spent 4 years consulting in Asia, so I wanted to get back. I interviewed with a few places, and eventually KPMG were growing, and there was opportunities there. It was my first exposure to audit work. Audit's good and bad. You have to close your bank accounts if you're auditing an SEC-listed company, but, that's a minor thing. You learn a lot. You get to see a lot of what different companies are doing. But the secret is to move through different audit roles and not do the same thing. Did some product reviews, did lots of M&A, unit pricing reviews. I got to Gold Star status living in the Hilton in Edinburgh. That was great. I marked exams. I became an examiner for CA1. Apologies to anybody who sat CA1 back then. I started doing the specialist lecturing, getting quite involved with the Institute. I was on the working group for IFRS 17, back when IFRS 17 was still new. And obviously lots of marketing, recruitment, all of those types of things. Africa, I think the biggest and easiest thing that enabled that move was the SAM, which is Solvency Assessment and Management. It's basically the equivalent of LAGIC or Solvency II. But the South Africans literally pinched the guy who was leading the UK regulator, put him in the South African regulator. He took lots of papers, and they copied everything. So it made life quite easy. Again, I did a sort of role for about a year. I was running the whole practice down there. The partner decided to go and start another business. So that was the most stressful year of my life. IFRS 17 again featured a lot. I think when I left, we just won our first IFRS 17 project. Continued with some audit work and also did internal audit work, which is again quite interesting because you learn a lot. The M&A work continued, and I saw lots of very interesting business models. They do things quite differently in South Africa. And then the newer things started to sort of pop up, the analytics and the wider fields. And to me, it's quite scary how quickly those things have become as important as they've become, because 3 years ago, nothing. We did a lot of outsourced actual functions and all the management type roles. So back in Sydney, again, it's, straight into capital, management type things, presenting here. And I guess it's early days. I should mention I started in February this year. So, yeah, it's good. But I have to say it's nice to be back in Sydney. Sydney is a good city. It's got a great lifestyle, and it's got a very sort of relaxed environment. You just need to look at the news about Johannesburg to see why I say that. So there's a lot of good things about traveling and about going overseas. you learn a lot about actual works, you get involved in different types of works, you eat interesting food. That was the best thing for me. The food in Sydney is pretty good these days. You see interesting places. You're always learning. That's good and bad, especially in consulting. You're always going to do things that you've probably never done before. Regulations are similar but different everywhere, so you're really learning a lot. Visas, always a pain. I was lucky enough to have an ancestral visa for the UK, but yeah, that's paperwork's a bit of a hassle. Renewing that visa in the bottom of the immigration thing with, you know, a whole bunch of other people, it wasn't fun. Banking, obviously, open accounts all over the place gets messy. And tax is always one that, you know, you got to make sure your tax is up to date over there before you get your money out of the country. It's a pain. CPD schemes also. I have three CPD schemes, the South African, the UK, and the Australian. I've got a spreadsheet model that models them all. The South Africans decided to mess that up by changing it to be outcomes-based, so you no longer measure hours. It's a better system, but messed my model up. And the biggest thing is you make a lot of friends and you get to know a lot of people. The worst thing about that is they're all over the place. So wherever I go, I've got a place to stay, but it's a lot of work to keep that going. Should you go, should you stay? For the observant people in the list, a couple of my titles have been song lines, but anyway. I think the actual profession really helps in this. There are places, America is very different, the way they study is different, Europe is very different, but that actual qualification in Asia, in the UK, in South Africa, that opens a lot of doors. It's a really small world, and that's something that you need to bear in mind. This is me and Rick Shaw having dinner. It's blackened fish, very nice. It's a bit of a communication issue, so we each got a whole fish. We ate it all. It was very good. So that's me and Rick in Yemen in 2001. Rick is now a partner in Deloitte, where I work currently. As well as that, there's a couple other people. Don Johnson, not the Miami Vice guy, the actuary. I worked with him in KPMG in London. There's a guy from South Africa who I didn't even realize had moved over here and sort of wandered into the office, and there he was. So the actual profession is small, the world's small. Networks, very important. I think, you know, the move to Malaysia was pretty easy. The job ad came, the interview came, I had the Moses experience. It was a no-brainer. Moving to the UK was a lot harder. I didn't know anybody. Took a whole 6 weeks, you know. But 6 weeks when eating crackers and hummus is a long time. The move to South Africa, easy. The partner I worked for, KPMG, called the partner in South Africa. The guy called me. We spoke for 10 minutes. He said, when can I start? Then we had to do all the formalities, but, you know. And similarly, the move to Australia, exactly the same. The partner in South Africa called the partner here. A couple of interviews later, here I am. So that network is incredibly important. Don't ever forget that. And networking is not about anything other than keeping up with your friends who happen to be in the same profession as you. I think if you go, be adventurous. There's no point going and just going for work. I think you've got to get out there and go and actually see things and do things. And a lot of the time, especially for business trips, business travel, terrible. But the best business trips I had was when I'd fly out on a Saturday instead of Monday morning, and then go and do the open bus stop tour around Berlin or something like that. Very, very much fun. I think there's green grass everywhere. Don't go because you think it'll be better. It's better everywhere. So don't go for the wrong reasons. And the world's not that scary. I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there and a lot of sort of horrible things happen. But, you know, on the whole, I've been to some pretty dodgy places and I'm still in one piece. Don't be reckless. That's also sound advice. And I think perspective, you know, what you want really changes over time. So for me, when I left 20 years ago, I kind of didn't know what I wanted. You know, it sounded like a good adventure. Salary was good. The travel opportunities were good. Now, I've got two kids. You know, I'd rather go home at night than go traveling. I do have lots of really good memories, and I brought some souvenirs back. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. That was amazing. It was really good to see that you had some time to stop and smell the roses, or time to actually do some work as well. and you made those transitions seem really seamless, so well done. I hope it's that easy in real life. Right, next up, it is. That's good. Good to hear. Next up, we've got Elizabeth Martin. Liz Martin is a consulting actuary who has recently returned to Australia after working in London. Over the past 10 years, she has worked with clients across a range of industries and countries, including Hong Kong, Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, and the UK, specialising again in M&A and strategic initiatives. She, of course, loves to travel and would love to be a food and travel writer one day, wouldn't we all? Welcome, Liz.
Thank you. It's great to see so many people here today. I don't think we had such tailored events for young actuaries when I first became one, so it's great to see everyone here to support it today. As Avanti mentioned, I love to travel. If it's my favourite hobby, if you can call it that. I did a tally. I didn't have the map, but did a tally when I was putting this together. I think it's 28 countries in the last 10 years that I can remember. So certainly been making the most of it, and I've been fortunate enough to combine a bit of travel with my career, so that's been great as well. So I've been over in the UK for the last couple of years, so I just came back in February, so I'll talk a bit about my experience over there, some of the things I've learnt, and a few tips for the end if you're thinking of going. There's probably too much to cover everything all in this, so if you've got any questions, do ask in the question time. Happy to go through anything that any of the experiences. So I thought before I start, I'd just go through a bit of my career timeline, focusing on my experience overseas. So I started in Tillinghast, and I got a bit of international experience quite early on. I remember my first week as a new grad, and my boss pulls me aside and says, we've got this project going on in Hong Kong, are you interested in going? And I thought, that's fantastic, love to go. So the following week, me and the other grad were on a plane to Hong Kong for 3 weeks. So that was a great opportunity to I guess, get into it, and was my first taste of working overseas. Throughout the next couple of years, there'd be a couple more trips to Hong Kong, and then in about 2008, the company was doing a really big modelling project in Tokyo, and they had resources from all over the world, and some of my colleagues were there for about a year, and I ended up spending about 3 months working in Tokyo. And the benefit of working on these longer periods overseas is that you can really get to see a country, a city. You've got your work colleagues taking you out to dinner, and you know, you're with the locals, you're taking public transport. So it's a much better way than just the kind of fly-in, fly-out that consultants usually do. So I moved over to Deloitte. I worked on a project in Auckland, so it was about 6 months where I was there once every 3 weeks to meet the team there. So we were looking at their mortgage books, so analysing their customer data to see why people leave and if we could work out strategies to help them stay. But that was quite an interesting taste of New Zealand and seeing the market over there. And I also, I've done quite a lot of work in transactions, and so one of the clients I worked for was a South Korean client, and so I got to spend a week there meeting their team and taking them through our analysis. And then a very memorable trip to Hong Kong where my boss could make the management presentations and I had to go on my own. So that was quite a great experience for me. So then at this point in time, I'd had a taste of working overseas, and I was ready to do something for a bit of a longer period of time. So I spoke to my boss and said, I'm interested in a secondment. So she contacted some of the partners overseas to see what's the common opportunities were available. So nothing had come up just yet, but I was working with Trang Duncanson. I'm not sure if she's here, but I'm sure a lot of you have met her. And we were just having a chat about work, and she was saying, oh, have you seen the secondment to the global Deloitte IFRS Solvency II team? And I thought, oh, I haven't seen that. And at the time, I was interested in working in business development, and this role came up that was looking at developing marketing materials and tools and training to roll out to the whole of Deloitte globally. So I said, no, that sounds great. She sent me the application, which closed that evening, but luckily it was UK time, so I had some time to go home and put something together. So I went through the application process, and eventually they selected me to go overseas. And I think the interesting thing about that project, or that's a common opportunity, was it wasn't actuarial at all. So they were taking people from all disciplines, and the reason that they selected me in the end is they wanted someone to work on IFRS 17 predominantly, and having the Australian margin on services being the closest thing to IFRS 17, they thought the Australian experience would be useful. So I think it's a good example of how the actual profession can take you somewhere where you didn't really expect to go. So I was over there for 6 months, came back, ended up moving to TAL for a year, and then had what I like to refer to as my third of a life crisis, where I'd been working for 10 years. I tried a few different things and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with my career. And then also in the back of my mind, I'd always wanted to live in France, and I was getting closer to the age where you could no longer be eligible for a youth visa. So I thought about it for a while and then ended up quitting my job, getting a visa and a plane ticket over to France, without too much of a plan, I must say. And so France didn't work out quite as I'd hoped. I don't know if anyone's ever tried to live in France before, but it feels like trying to navigate the French admin system is almost impossible. So I remember turning up with all my documents, making an appointment with the bank manager to try and open a bank account, and she was looking through the documents and she's like, well, do you have a job offer? And I said, no, I'm still looking for a job. Would you have an address? I'm like, well, no, I don't have a house yet. So she said, well, I can't give you a bank account. So I'm like, okay, well, next step, let's try and find somewhere to live. So then tried to get a lease. Do you have a bank account? No. So, and then similarly, I think this is probably obvious now that I say it, but if you're in France, I mean, the websites are in French, everything is in France. So if you're sitting there in Google typing in English, jobs in France, it'll only return English searches and you won't get anything. So, and even the search, you know, even when I could find a French website, my limited French didn't quite cut it. So trying to get all these things in place didn't quite work as planned. And after a few discussions with my partner who came over, we thought, it's only a year, let's don't worry about the work, we'll just travel. So spent 3 or 4 months of travelling all around Europe, which had an amazing experience, really loved it. But then at some point I missed the routine and I got a bit sick of living out of a suitcase and constantly moving around, and so and wasn't quite ready to return to Australia. So I thought, okay, well, the best thing I think at the moment is to get a job. We can settle here for a bit, travel on the weekends. So I started looking at jobs. And being over in Europe, so I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but being in Europe, I needed to be sponsored. And the best way to get a sponsored position was to become an actuary, well, to work as an actuary again. So luckily overseas, actuaries are probably as in demand as they are here. So applied for a few jobs all over Europe, Switzerland, Italy, and ended up taking the job in London in the UK. So was there for a couple of years and just returned in February. So I think from my perspective, I didn't go overseas to try and advance my career or to become a better actuary, but more that being an actuary enabled me to pursue my interest of travel. So I think that's one of the benefits of the profession. So what did I learn in my time in the UK? The first thing is it was a lot harder than I expected. So, I mean, I went through my dramas of trying to work in France, but I think the experience of trying to find somewhere to live, bank accounts, being in a new country, trying to find where the local supermarket is, all these things you take for granted, I think. When you put in a new environment, it is challenging, and I don't say this to dissuade you at all. It's just if you find yourself in a situation where you've got housemates from hell, or you can't find somewhere to live, or you've been through 20 interviews and you've got a job, that not to be disheartened, that it really is all part of the process and it does work out in the end. The other thing is that from a work perspective, I knew it would be difficult, but I think it was harder than I thought. So going over there, you've got new products to work with, a whole bunch of companies you've never heard before, regulations are totally different. And I think it had more of an impact on my work than I thought, because every single piece of work that I needed to do was all of a sudden in a new context. So I found myself often having to go back to basics to say, well, is what I'm saying applicable in the new regulatory world that I am here? And I think for me, that definitely made me a better consultant, because I think in your career, you kind of build knowledge incrementally. And so you kind of forget what you know and what's assumed knowledge and what other people know. So I think every time I had to explain something, I didn't know, because it was all new to me, I didn't know what their knowledge was, and so I had to start almost from basics. And I think that actually made the communication so much better, and it's definitely something I'm more conscious of now that I'm back, even though I'm a lot more in a much more familiar environment. And I think the other thing that I learned from that is I think I'm a much better manager now for the experience. So the last time I had a big life change, I would say, was probably when I went from university to work, and there's a massive learning curve and you're always learning new things. And I think after working for 10 years, you kind of forget the feeling of what it's like to be thrown in the deep end and sink or swim kind of thing. So which is definitely how I felt when I started in London. So I think now I've got a better understanding of how other people might feel and the support that they might need when they're taking on something new or outside of their comfort zone. So then the next thing is, particularly for London, is the diversity. So I always thought Australia was quite a diverse place, but London really is like a little version of the whole world. So even in my team, maybe a quarter of the team was from the UK. And then of that, like, there was a handful that grew up in London. So everyone else was from Sweden, France, Germany, Africa, Australia, New Zealand. So the benefit of that was that every time we had a challenge to work through, everyone could bring their perspectives from their own country, their own experience, and it made for so much more of an interesting discussion than perhaps I've had here, where everyone's had a similar experience and similar, I guess, backgrounds. So, but then also not just that, the team's interests were so diverse. So we had people who did musical theatre, we had different sports, so many different interests, and the people were so interesting, and the friends that I made over there, I still keep in touch with my colleagues now. So I think it's just a chance to expand your network and meet people that you might not have met without going overseas. Then the work is so interesting and different. And before I left, I think there was maybe, you could say there was maybe five issues that would constantly come up in a work situation. And we sort of, I've spent my whole career like trying to solve the same five issues in different ways. So when I went over to the UK, I mean, they were all their issues were new to me. It's not stuff I'd come across before, and it's quite possible they'd been talking about the same issues for 10 years, but I hadn't experienced them, so it was interesting for me. So things like if you work in life insurance, There's, you know, UK, the with profits guaranteed business or annuity businesses, longevity issues, economic capital is a lot more focused, and financial reinsurance, which doesn't quite exist here. So you do get to involve in a lot of different areas than you would here. And then similarly for GI, the Lloyd's of London market is completely different to what you would work on here. So telematics and cyber are quite new and areas that are receiving a lot of focus. And similarly for if you work in superannuation, there's a lot of deficits in the defined benefit scheme, and they're just starting to set up their own compulsory super system. So there's a lot of areas where you'd get experience there that you wouldn't necessarily get here, and I think all of it's still relevant and stuff you could bring back to Australia. So I've just got one example of one of the projects I worked on, just to show the differences. So I work a lot in transactions. So I was working on the sell side for one of our clients. So the first interesting thing was the company itself. So in Australia, I'm quite used to working for one insurance company that wants to buy another insurance company, and you're working kind of with the actuarial teams and due diligence, that kind of thing. So this company was formed from a management buyout. So essentially, the management team of this product line wanted to break away from the main company. But in order to do that, they needed money, so they partnered with a private equity firm. And to get the capital, they entered into a complex financial reinsurance arrangement with one of the reinsurers. So this was interesting in itself, and as part of the sales process, we had to explain this in our valuation report as to how the profits are recognised, where it goes, how the structure works on capital. So for me, that was fascinating. And then the reason we were going through the sales process is because they didn't have shareholders, and their strategy to grow was to buy other businesses. So if they wanted to buy a business, they needed money, they couldn't go to the shareholders, so they had to sell parts of their business to be able to buy other businesses. So that was fascinating, and all of the parties interested in buying were all private equity type companies. So the information that a private equity firm looks at is completely different to what an actuarial buyer might look at. So for me, the whole experience was completely different, and a great chance to improve my communication, to work with clients outside of our traditional actuarial area. So my final learning was that it really broadens the mind, and I think if you're going to take away anything from this talk, it's definitely this one. So my perspective has totally changed from before I went overseas to now that I've come back, and it's for a whole range of reasons. You know, from the start, like, I didn't know how long I'd be overseas for, so I went through a process of getting rid of stuff. It's amazing how many things just aren't important. And then living out of a suitcase for 6 months, you don't need as much, I think, as you think you do. And then Australia is one place, you know, a great place in the world, but the world's such a big place, and I think being overseas, you do see there is a whole world of other experiences there, and it's definitely changed my perspective. And when I look at things, I guess I've just have a much broader view of things than I did perhaps before I went. And then there's obviously the chance to see other cultures, to meet different people, different perspectives, different food, that kind of thing. So it really was, I think, for me, I absolutely learnt so many things in my work experience that have really helped me since I've been back, but also just me as a person, I've really been able to broaden my perspective, and I think that in itself was, you know, such a great reason to go, that if you're thinking of going at all, just go. Don't even think about it. So hopefully I've convinced everyone to go. So a few tips for when you're planning. So I think definitely learn about the local market. So if you're going to Europe, Solvency II is key. Learn learn about what the top 10 companies are, what's their names, what's kind of their revenue, profit, how are they formed, how are products distributed, that kind of thing, so that when you actually get there, you have a better understanding and you can, it's not such a steep learning curve, particularly legislations as well. How does the market work? We're quite unique in life insurance where we have MOS reporting. No one else has that, so just understanding what they do is key. And I think definitely use your network. So not just to try and get jobs, which is an awesome, I mean, if you've got connections over there, it makes it so much easier, but also just for your setting up your network and having people to talk to. And it can be quite an isolating experience if you're over there on your own without, I guess, familiar faces. And I think if you go to a big city like London or New York, there will be absolutely someone you know there. I think when I was over there, there was maybe 6 of my ex-Tillinghast colleagues I've met kind of in Australia, overseas along the way, and we all used to catch up every few months for a drink or something. So it's just, there are people all over the world, and I think really make the most of your network. And these events are good at making new networks. And then I think it'll be much, so these are nice to have, so it's so much easier if you're qualified. So firstly, you don't want to be studying overseas, you'd much rather be travelling. But also I found some of the companies would like you to switch to their system. So obviously if you're studying the Australian system, it's a different route to qualification. So going to somewhere like London or the UK, London or the US, there's more of a drive for employers to ask you to move over just because that's what they're familiar with, and you don't want to throw away however many years of study you've done here. It's so much easier if you have a job before you go. So one, you don't have to spend time through interviews, but I also found in the UK market and probably other markets that they're quite hesitant if you've not got experience in the local market. So once you've got your first job, it's fine, but that securing that first job can be quite difficult because they have to trust you and to, I guess, see you through that initial learning curve as you learn about the market. So if you can get a job before you go, then you sort of have probably a more successful chance of getting one in it, because it can take some time otherwise. And the last one is to go before you're 31. So that's not just because you're less likely to have commitments and that kind of thing, but most countries will give Australians a youth visa before they turn 31, and usually there's very few restrictions on that. So, for example, in the UK, there's a 2-year working holiday visa. You can work for any company for any amount of time, and it makes it so much easier for the employer because they don't have to sponsor you. And it also, for you as an individual, it doesn't tie you to one employer. So definitely if you're thinking of going, I would take advantage of the youth visas. You can only use one per country, but they have them for UK, France, I kind of remember that there's so many different countries, and you can move from one to the next if you want to. Canada, I think, so definitely take advantage of that. And then finally, have fun. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Liz. That was very, very interesting. And again, I'm very jealous. Nice photos up there. Alrighty, maybe we'll just start getting the speakers up on stage. So Jazz, Ray and Liz, if you could make your way up, and we'll start getting some questions going. So I'll open up the floor to any questions, and also keep in mind that people on the webinar are free to ask questions as well. So any questions to begin with? No, silence. Oh, amazing. Tim, you need to let other people speak too, you know, Tim. Yeah, go for it.
Sorry, it's Tim again. Just a question on, I think Liz mentioned about transferring, as an employer overseas wants to transfer the membership. Actually, it's more towards Jazz. But so what is it like? Is it difficult to transfer from, say, FIA to FIA, et cetera. Can you give us more insights on that? Is it easy? Is it difficult?
It's a microphone. Yeah. My understanding is, yes, it is. If you're a fellow of the Australian Institute, right now I'm trying to get a membership of the UK Institute. It's a pretty seamless process. The one of the American ones, the FSC, I think, not the general insurance ones. In America, they have two fellowships. One is the big one, and one's focused on GI. The GI one's a hard one. They're a bit more, you know, we are the best and we won't let anyone. But the other guys are pretty open. UK and even with South Africa. I'm a fellow of the Singapore Institute, for example. You know, it's pretty seamless. So Australian qualification is a fantastic passport.
We've got a question up here as well.
Hi, my name is Ida from EY. So I would like to work overseas, and I would also like to maintain a work-life balance while I'm over there. I know the speakers have kind of alluded to this already, but I wanted to ask explicitly which countries where you could get that work-life balance more easily.
A work-life balance is up to you to secure. yeah, there's always work to be done, so if you go anywhere, you can work 24/7 if you feel like it. I think it's sort of breaking out of that peer pressure. That's tough to do, but do it.
I'd probably just add to that, from my experience, the hours, I think that would be quite difficult in Asia. So Tokyo is one of my favourite cities, but it is long hours. So, but having said that, in Europe, I had a great work-life balance when working in London. I rarely worked past 6 o'clock and I was in consulting. So the employment regulations in Europe, because of the European Union, are a lot stricter than, say, Australia. So if you work in particularly continental Europe, you sign up to 35 hours a week, basically. So I'd recommend Europe.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things there. I think, firstly, people should be... Whilst Australia has a reputation for being laid back and relaxed, it's actually one of the hardest working countries that I've seen. So certainly in Europe, when I worked there, and like Liz was saying, the hours are on average better. And also depends on the kind of employer you go to. If you go to an investment bank or a consulting firm, obviously the work-life balance is not as to the balance side as it is in a corporate. Asia, again, you know, they have a history of working really hard, working in the office long. But for some of the senior people who've gone there, who are doing more management type roles, the hours are not bad. So it just kind of depends on where you land and what level you land at.
And I think you've got to also be aware of culture, because sometimes people are in the office to be seen to be in the office. They're not actually working. And that's why I say don't get suckered into it. Just, you know, pick your bags up, say very loudly, goodbye, and go.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's actually very important to do that when you first start, because once you set that tone, no one's going to stop you.
Awesome. More frank advice from Jazz. Thanks, guys. we've got a question up here as well.
My name is Francesca. I work at Finity. I had a kind of specific question, well, for both Liz and Ray. For Liz, when you were looking at applying for jobs, you said you applied for some in various places in Europe, but you ended up taking one in the UK. Did you find that, given that you didn't speak another language, it was harder than you thought to find roles that were interesting to you in continental Europe?
I'd say no. So I applied for a job in Switzerland and went through the interview process, and it was just the job wasn't quite right. And the first job I actually got offered was in Italy. And the Italian I mean, it was a global company, and so they spoke English in the head office. And the reason I didn't take that one was because they've never sponsored an Australian before, and me and their HR person were trying to figure out how to do it, and it just didn't seem like it was going to work. So the recruiters I spoke to over there, I mean, language is a nice to have, but realistically the companies that I was applying for had head offices in that. So, for example, Score in Paris or Generali in Italy, in the head office they speak English, so that wasn't an issue. Consulting was more of a challenge working in continental Europe because they work with smaller clients and you do need to know the language. But as long as you target a head office, it's usually okay. And they have, I mean, a whole load of interesting roles there.
Okay, that's great. And Ray, just I noticed that you said that you worked in Argentina and Mexico. Do you think that there's any opportunities for us to work in those maybe more developing markets? Like as a full-time position, not just like a business trip?
Yeah, definitely. There's always opportunities, I think. So when I was in Argentina, it was just before the sort of big fallout and currency devaluation and all of that sort of stuff. So obviously, economic circumstances aside, I think there's probably opportunities just about everywhere. You do have to speak Spanish in Argentina.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I ate a brain pie or something because I couldn't speak Spanish, but tasted all right. Mexico, I know a guy in London who's a Mexican actor, and he left, but I think he was sort of a bit like me, wanted to travel. So they do have a profession in Mexico, and Mexico is a lovely place.
Yeah.
My honeymoon was Cuba and Mexico, so yeah, well worth going.
Hey, thank you.
I'd just like to add one thing to that is if you are interested in those parts of the world, one option is to get a job with a company with operations there. For example, QBE is a good example with operations in Latin America, and I have known people who've moved to South America with them.
Any more questions across the floor? Yep.
Hi, I'm Natalie from AMP. Liz earlier mentioned that it's good to secure a job before moving to another country, and I think we all went through that when we graduated uni and tried to get our first job. It's really hard to get that first job without having an experience in the industry already. So do you have any tips to share with us in terms of how to secure a job overseas without actually working over there?
So I think, I mean, firstly, to Jazz's point, too, if you have a job here and can transfer, which I've done a couple of times, that really helps. But I think the recruitment agents overseas, or probably even here as well, can really help out with that. So, that's to get the foot in the door. But when you go through the interview process, I think it's important to be aware that that's going to be an issue for the person hiring, and to have a response for that. So even though the job I ended up getting in London was through a connection, so he'd completely vouched for me, said I was great, all that kind of stuff. In the interview, the partner did ask me that, you know, we think this is going to be a challenge, how are you going to address it? And I certainly think you need a response to that to be able to show that the experience you have here is totally applicable over there. I think one of the main things to note as well is that Australia is a small market and we're really far away. And so whenever I'm looking at an issue, I don't look at it in the context of Australia. I'll definitely see what's happening in the UK and the US as a comparison point and to use those examples. So we are quite familiar with overseas markets already. And I think it's important to draw some of these points out because it will come up as an issue.
But I'd just like to add a completely different angle. As I wouldn't not go to a big market like London if I did, you know, only because I had secured a job. Like I would go there because it makes life a lot easier to get a job if you're there in person. And one of the other things Liz said earlier is you just go and do it. Yeah, by all means, do your homework and plan and all that kind of stuff. But just do it. I mean, that's just and you back yourself, and especially if you go to a big market, chances are you will get a contract role to start with at least, and then you can go permanent. And this is exactly what I tell people who want to come to Australia, is yes, by all means, we'll help you get a job from abroad, but if it's not working out, just come here and things will change. And 9 out of 10 times, guess what, within landing here, within the land here, within a couple of months, they have a role.
Thanks. I think we had a question from the centre of the floor as well. Nope. Any more questions? Right, I think we're close to wrapping up, but I've got one final question for you guys. You've got the token question. One key attribute that we can start building today to actually have a very global career in the future. Go. Well, we can get Jas to start first. I'm sure you've got lots to say.
Okay, one thing. I'd say language. Pick a language. If you want to go to Europe or UK, pick a European one. If you want to go to America, English is obviously here, but Spanish. Spanish because of the Latin American connection. And if you want to go to Asia, Mandarin, I would say. Or Japan, different. But a language.
I'd probably say two things. So one, your network, and not just because obviously you can't just build a network overseas, but the job I got in London was from someone I knew in Australia, and people travel and people change their circumstances. So I think definitely making as many contacts as you can will help you if you do want to live overseas. But then also I think, as I touched on before, just trying to incorporate as much of global interests and activities and that kind of thing in your work, day-to-day work, because whatever you're doing, there's always an example of something happening overseas, and if you're aware of that kind of thing, it makes it so much easier if you do want to travel, and just having that global perspective.
Yep, I think good points, and for me, I'd just say be curious, ask lots of questions. You know, when you get over there, I think that's the best way of demonstrating that you've thought about it, is to find out about the people over there and what they're doing, why they're doing it.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. If we could put our hands together for our lovely speakers.